Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's EcoLogic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan, and today we're joined by Chelsea Congdon. She was a water resources specialist for the Environmental Defense Fund for 10 or 11 years, the water program director for Public Council of the Rockies. She then went on to become a film and media producer, telling compelling stories. And more recently, she co-founded the Global Diversity Narrative Project. So just delighted to have Chelsea on the podcast today. Hey, Chelsea, welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
Hi, Ted. Nice to hear from you. I'm great. Thank you very much.
Good to see you. Good to hear your voice and want to hear all about what you're doing. But I've already introduced you, and you're specialist in water and filmmaking and the narratives. So let's just pause and go all the way back. Grew up where?
You know, I grew up in Colorado. I'm a native, and I was born and raised in Denver and spent most of my summers and weekends in Aspen because my parents were people who were among the first to have a little house in Aspen way back in the late 1950s.
Were you skiing summer and winter, or winter and summer?
No, we were skiing in the winter and, you know, hiking and goofing around in the summer, but it was part of our growing up. We didn't have our own school age friends were all in Denver, but you know, Aspen or the Roaring Fork Valley was really sort of embedded in my life from the very beginning.
And yeah, so made you a naturalist right from the start.
Made me a naturalist right from the start. Exactly.
Now I was interested doing it. You know, I was a little poking around. So you went back east for boarding school?
I did. I think my father had the opinion that I would get a proper education there that might not be possible in the public school system in Denver. So off I was sent to Phillips Andover Academy and was there for a couple of years. And that was a big adventure for me because I really was kind of a hick.
Yeah. Yeah. And there you were from Colorado. I mean, I grew up on the East Coast and we all went to prep school. But, you know, and there was just a few kids that were from Colorado and fewer even that were from California. But that must have been a great shaping experience. And then you went to Berkeley, right? You went to ERG? Or not to ERG. You went to UC Berkeley as an undergraduate, right?
I did. I got a great education in Andover. And my father had strong ideas that I should stay east and keep doing things that he would do. And so I went to Berkeley to make sure we knew who was driving the bus. And I spent a couple of years at Berkeley and loved it as an undergraduate and really got to a point where I felt like it was a little bit too big for that stage of my education and didn't want to admit it, but I transferred back to Yale where my father would want me to go to school and I finished college there.
Good for you. Well, good for him, right? And good for you.
He won.
Now, look, I made myself some tea before the podcast, and this, you can't read it, but this is the UC Berkeley mug here.
I can see it, yeah.
That I did grab in your honor. But then you went back to Berkeley for graduate school, or was there anything in between that?
Yeah, there was. You know, I had finished at Yale and was really interested, I had gotten very interested in water resources, and Yale had offered to keep me on as a graduate student, but admitted that they didn't have anybody focusing on Western water. And I looked at University of Michigan, and then I thought I would just take a break. So I moved back to the West Coast and lived in the Bay Area and worked as an environmental consultant and learned about a program at Berkeley called Energy and Resources Group that a lot of, I think, your guests and our Yep. mutual friends have attended, and thought that's the place for me because I really wanted to specialize in being a generalist. I wanted to be able to sort of integrate and find the intersections between technology and science and economics and policy and hydrology and not be a hydrologist or be a water attorney. So the Energy Resources Program was perfect for me. And that approach, I made sure that I applied to Energy Resources Group and I set off on a trip with a backpack around the world and I thought I'll come back if I get in, and I did, so I came back.
that's great. And then was EDF the next stop?
EDF was the next stop. There were a couple of my colleagues at Energy and Resources Group who were working at the Environmental Defense Fund in Oakland. And I was thrilled to be able to spend 10 or 11 years there working on California water issues, trying to take some of the same tricks from the energy field about incentives and demand management and markets, and turn that toward toward water and see where we could go. So we did some pretty interesting work on the Sacramento and San Joaquin rivers for I was there for about a decade. We kept going for a long time.
That's really interesting, taking program designs from the energy world to the water world.
Yeah, I think at the beginning people thought that that was going to be a pretty sort of hand and glove transfer, that it was going to be pretty easy to apply energy fixes and energy thinking to water. I think we've all learned that it's not quite that simple. Water's really decentralized, and water's very, you know, water's for fighting for. So
yeah. Tied up in all the water rights, it seems like. It seems
water
like
rights.
Very, very frustrating with the old water rights that don't make sense anymore, but are in place.
Exactly. I mean, we have kind of water policies and water rights that are 200 years old, and infrastructure that's 100 years old, and 21st century problems like population growth and climate change. And it's actually a train wreck. But it was back then, too. Today, there's no question. But
yeah, I think didn't they just come out with wasn't there a brand new report coming out on the Colorado River that is down like a trillion gallons or some, you know, unfathomable number of gallons?
Yeah, it's going to be, yes, they did. It's going to be new math. You know, they divided up that river in 1922 on the assumption that there were somewhere between 15 and 17 million acre feet of water to share between everybody, and the real number is about 11. So everybody's going to get a haircut.
Yeah, yeah. Now, what? So you did that job with EDF based in California then, I gather, for 11 years or so.
Mm-hmm, I
and
did.
Then you came back to Colorado?
I did. I was 30-something, and I kept talking about how I was a Colorado kid, and some friends of mine pointed out that in my 30s, if I was a Colorado kid, I should probably get back there. So I moved to the Boulder, Colorado office of the Environmental Defense Fund and had the opportunity for, oh, I don't know, 7 or 8 years to work on a project trying to link the Colorado River back to the Colorado River Delta, and seeing what it would take to get Mexico and the United States to sit down and look at some numbers and think about how to get creative about moving water across the border in a way that would keep wetlands and wildlife down in the border region alive. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it sounds very, very challenging.
It was very challenging. But
is that then the Public Council of the Rockies? Was that a subsequent position?
That was a subsequent position. I had worked at the Environmental Defense Fund for a good long time, and finally, as much as I loved it, felt like water is a very slow thing to change, and had the hubris to think that maybe you could change more hearts and minds if you told stories. So I became a documentary filmmaker with absolutely no experience in documentary filmmaking, but I hooked up with a couple of people who knew a lot, and I spent about 14 years making documentary films about mostly about wildlands, wilderness conservation, wildlife corridors, and telling stories about people, really inspiring people who had committed themselves to conservation and to wilderness in particular. And that was a lot of fun. And after my film partner is my husband, and after about 14 years, we realized that we would either make films together or stay married, but maybe not both. So that's where Public Council of the Rockies came in. I started a consulting project in the Roaring Fork Valley where I live, working on local rivers, the Roaring Fork, the Crystal, Castle Creek, Maroon Creek, trying to figure out ways to protect in-stream flows and make people sort of more aware of where the gaps or the pinch points in those rivers are and what people could do as stakeholders to put water back in the river when it needed it most.
Yeah, and so the Public Council of the Rockies was really based up in the Roaring Fork Valley.
Yes.
Is that right? And then the Castle Creek story is really, I think, a really interesting story. And as I understand it, there was an old hydro dam that was serving the city of Aspen that needed to be reconditioned or could be reconditioned. But you tell the story because it sounds like you're balancing renewable hydro generation with maintaining adequate stream flows and other environmental aspects. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the sort of interdisciplinary dimensions of trying to think about how to keep rivers flowing is that people assume sort of automatically that hydro is good because hydro is not fossil fuel. It's an alternative energy and it's, you know, clean. But there's bad hydro. There's bad hydro that really screws up a river. And in this case, the city of Aspen already had a small diversion on Maroon Creek outside of Aspen to take water out of the creek and run it through a turbine and put it back in and generated some electricity. And in the drive to become more green and cut the carbon footprint of Aspen even more, Aspen proposed a project to pretty much dewater a 7-mile stretch of the creek and take a great deal of the flows of the creek out, run them through a bigger turbine, generate more electricity for Aspen, and eventually put the water back in. And so ours was a project working with people from American Rivers and, you know, wonderful, creative, passionate people to try to educate the public of Aspen that the amount of water that you took out of the river was going to dry it up for some long stretch, and that Aspen needed to look for other green ways to produce energy without killing off this river at the same time. So it was a fascinating project, and I think Aspen learned a lot.
What happened at the end of the day?
The project got canceled. The citizens, they decided to put it back to the citizens for a vote, and the citizens voted it down.
But now that's fascinating. But the original diversion is in place and is generating power, still, as I understand it, right?
It's a small hydro diversion, and it still exists and does its job nicely. You know, Aspen ended up buying a lot of wind.
Right, instead. Mm-hmm. There's an author, Stephen Hawley, who's going to be on the podcast. He's scheduled in the next few weeks. He's just come out with a Patagonia book all about dams. And I've kind of thumbed through the book and I don't see any positive. It seems like there's no positives about dams at all. And of course, I come from the power sector and I'm like, wait a second. I like hydro. I thought hydro generation was a good thing.
That's part of the great train wreck. We're looking at people talking about large dams. They're also talking about large dams at a time where rivers are more threatened by pressures for water diversions and climate change and drought. I don't think there's so much a place for large hydropowered dams, yeah. But I think that there are people experimenting, say, with run-of-the-river dams so that you can put a turbine in the river and operate it in a way that the river continues to flow, and it's that flow that generates hydropower. People are putting hydropower in ditches around here. People put it in their gated pipe in their fields. So there are a lot of ways to generate hydro at a smaller scales, but I think the big dam hydro is probably on its way out.
Right.
It's very destructive.
Yeah. Going back to your storytelling, can you elaborate on a couple of the films that you made and the stories that you told and that sort of illustrated this sort of compelling storytelling?
Yeah. You know, the first film we made was called Subdivide and Conquer, a Modern Western. And it was about how at least in the Western United States, which was then and is now the fastest growing part of the country ever, we have this sort of insatiable habit of sort of gobbling up the next town and building a subdivision and then having to build a shopping center to pay for it and laying in all the utilities. And if you're to use local places in Colorado, if you're Telluride, you don't want to be Aspen. And if you're Aspen, you don't want to be Denver. And if you're Denver, you don't want to be somebody else. But they're all the same because of the way we incentivize growth. And so this was a film to sort of look at what the costs of that are from everything from air pollution, time people spend in their car, stress, chopping up landscapes and ruining habitat, pressures on water supply, cost, of course. So it was a really fun film to make in a really Western tradition. We had cowboys riding horses through intersections and doing all kinds of crazy things, but it really unpacked the problems of sprawl and compared them to what was then the really hot topic of smart growth and how to build walkable transport sort of focused communities. And when we started it, people said, "What? You're making a movie about sprawl? That sounds like the most boring thing in the world." And that was my first reaction. But it was a fascinating project. And as luck would have it, when we finished that film in 2001, 23 states had just passed a ballot initiative in the November election to put a sales tax on in local communities to help create a fund to purchase open space and to protect landscapes. And so Subdivide and Conquer just kind of took off. It had an exciting run.
You know, I was sort of chuckling because I had a band I don't know if I ever told you this, but I had a band years ago when I was in New York called the Urban Sprawl.
Oh, you're kidding.
And we were on the suburbs of, you know, Long Island, and it was the sprawl. And nobody in the band knew what that meant at all. I mean, I had come from a land use planning background and everything, but it just seemed like a really cool name for a band. And so, and then the nickname was The Sprawl. So that word is near and dear to my heart.
We should have used your music. Darn.
I had Greg Poschman on the show, on the podcast, your county commissioner from Pitkin County, as you know, and just talking about how to balance, you know, this insatiable drive for development and growth in like the Roaring Fork Valley with maintaining the quality of the valley, certainly maintaining it as a habitat even for wildlife. And I was going to ask you, we have the monastery that's up in Old Snowmass, up the road from the homes that we have there, is closing. And I know you've been very involved with local, the local caucus there and local politics there. What do you think is going to happen with that? I mean, here's again, a large piece of land that I'm sure there's going to be all sorts of pressures to develop it one way or another.
Yeah, I love spending time on that neighborhood caucus board with your daughter Sierra. I think that cooler minds will prevail, and that 4,000 acre gem of a piece of land that is such fabulous habitat and has incredibly rich water rights and pasture, I think it will be largely conserved. There is tremendous pressure, as I understand it, from the church to have the monks leave, which they are in the process of doing, and sell that acreage to the highest bidder. I think our neighborhood group has prevailed in appealing to the monks to sort of do a little soul searching and think about how they want this place to look in the long term, and how there might be some very limited, carefully planned development out there that yields the kind of some kind of return that would satisfy the church and doesn't end up turning that into a golf course or a luxury development, which I think were the first things we were all hearing about.
Right. So,
fingers crossed.
You know, I guess just as a sort of a theme of our conversation, how do you handle just growth? I mean, you know, more and more water use, land use. I mean, how do you handle this ever-increasing population? And of course, you can't blame people for wanting to come to, say, paradise, the Roaring Fork Valley of Colorado.
Yeah, you know, I think what we're all engaged in at some level, and each in our own ways, is trying to first learn and then teach or communicate the possibilities around living here differently. I mean, until we get comfortable about talking about population control, which doesn't seem to work, we really need to begin to imagine ourselves happy and thriving and fed and comfortable on this planet in a way that is not as fraught by tremendous pressures to develop and consume and throw away. And that's true whether you're in energy or water or land use. I think we need to live here differently.
Yeah. When I came to LA to work, to be the director of energy efficiency for the city, I thought, oh, I don't really want to do that. But you know, I think I might have said this to you before, I considered LA the land of conspicuous consumption. Mm-hmm. And so what greater place to be a director of energy efficiency and to try to move people away from that. But I agree with you. I think this highly consumptive society is really at the issue, and probably not population. In fact, there's some that say, you know, the collective intelligence, the more people we have, the better the intelligence we have, we'll be collectively better off. But we've got to get off of this this throughput society, right?
Mm-hmm. I think that's right, and I agree with you. I mean, I have heard too that we could host, this planet could host lots of numbers of people if we were living here differently. And I think that, you know, the agency that we have as activists or scientists or social scientists, policymakers, is to try to change, you know, the rules, right? Mm-hmm. with regulations or policies, or try to change behavior with incentives. And all of those things are really important, but at some level, I think we need to capture people's imagination about that change and living in more balance with nature and with the rest of life on this earth is actually possible.
And better quality of life is possible when we're more attuned to Earth's ecosystems, right?
I think so. And we've gotten pretty far away from that. We've lived for, you know, hundreds of years, thousands of years now with this mentality that popped up that said we're sort of separate and superior to nature, that we're outside of it, that we can manipulate it for our own means. And here we are in an era that is now labeled the Anthropocene, which means we're the only game in town. And we need to change that story. We need to remember that every other breath you take comes from phytoplankton in the ocean. And an acidifying ocean is not a good thing if you like breathing. And we need to get sort of back into a sense of kinship with the rest of our life on this planet and use all of our creativity and intelligence to figure out how are we going to live here without wrecking it. And yeah. I think that's possible. I mean, that's kind of why I get up every day. There are days that I think, maybe not, but we got to give it a try.
Well, and I think we all have to take it upon ourselves. I was thinking about myself as you were talking there. You know, I love woodworking and I have lots of tools. And when I buy a shiny new tool, I'm pretty fulfilled. You know, I'm part of that consumptive. I mean, maybe I didn't even need that, right? So, I mean, I think we all have to kind of look at our own lives and just sort of realize where we're part of that, I guess they call it a treadmill of consumerism that's been sort of drilled into us. And of course, we have advertising and TV, everything making it, everything amplifying all that. Mm-hmm. Let's shift a little bit and talk about the Global Diversity Narrative Project. We're not too far off because we're still talking about storytelling, I gather, but about that project.
Well, that's a project, the Global Biodiversity Narrative Project, started in 2019 when Maggie Fox, who you might know, and I had some long conversations about how to use film and nature films to help engage and inspire people to care about biodiversity and protecting life on this planet. And that led us into a really interesting discovery. She had, as you probably know, worked on the Climate Reality Project with Al Gore for a long time. And we were both just head scratching about how do you use all of these skills that we and our colleagues have in terms of policy making and science and storytelling and whatnot to change people's behavior. Because you can have a climate accord and you can have, now we have a global biodiversity, we have a global deal for nature that says we're going to protect 30% of the planet by 2030. That's a great idea. But we're missing something. We're missing the drive from the grassroots, from the ground, of people to say, yeah, I want to live on a thriving planet. And so our work in the Global Biodiversity Narrative Project is to look at the story or the narrative that we all live in, which is our cultural story. It's a story we share. It's not lectured at you. It's in ads. Mm. It's in music. It's in, you know, in the newspaper. It's at the dinner conversation. It's the sort of conditioning we have to see ourselves as somehow dominant in the web of life and able to live without the life support that we get from nature. And that mindset is behind the climate crisis. It's behind the biodiversity crisis. It's behind social justice and economic rights, crises around social justice and economic rights, because we see things as other. We see nature as other, and therefore available for our use. And we see other people as other. They're not as good as we are, or not as important as we are. And that othering is impoverishing us, and it's impoverishing the planet. So our project has been, let's take this story, this narrative that we humans have been living in for a while, and figure out, how would you begin to change it? Where would you start to seed new conversations and aspirations about living here differently? And how would you spread that through cultures, the culture globally, not just in the United States, so that people could start to feel invited, engaged, excited about a future they could imagine that would be better on a thriving planet than the one we're headed to? And if you talk to human behavior scientists, they'll tell you that there are three things that make people change their behavior. The first one is sort of the enabling conditions. If you outlaw plastic bags in Rwanda, then there are no plastic bags in Rwanda, and you've taken care of that for the most part. Another thing is an experience of awe that just, you know, leaves you back on your heels and changed forever. And the third one is a story told that you can see yourself in and imagine some sense of possibility and agency. So we are trying to use story and the possibility that we could live in relationship, in a right relationship with nature and each other, as a way to try to bring real spirit and conviction to the social movement that's focused on saving biodiversity on the planet, the social movement that's focused on climate change, because we really need people individually and as communities to engage in a way that they're
isn't
not
happening. Yeah. I love the mission intended to fuel the shift. Great language. And then, but what's the media? Will the story be a video or audio or written or all of the above, or how do you get those stories out there?
Well, we're really in the sort of pre-launch phase of this work, but the focus groups we've done around the world, talking to people, young people, indigenous people, lots of really inspired, passionate conservationists have been that if you want to change a story in culture, you use culture. And the part of culture that inspires us the most is art, right? When you listen to music, when you see a play, when somebody's painted something or they're creating something with their hands. And so we are focusing on identifying and inviting artists from around the world who are already immersed in creating art that suggests the possibility of living in harmony with nature and each other, and bringing those people together to try to see what they can co-create, and look for ways to amplify that and share it more globally. So you're carrying this message, this new story and culture with emotion, right? Yeah. Not data and fear and facts and just beating people over the head with 1.5 degrees and a million species, because people, you're a deer in the headlights when that happens. That doesn't motivate anybody. We're really, you know, we're kind of senior elder environmentalists. So I don't know if this is the last act, but it's informed by a lot of experience. And we're thinking, how do you bring heart into this? Yeah. And heart, will come with art, we think. So we have a partner called the Global Youth Biodiversity Network, which is a group of hundreds of thousands of youth leaders around the world who have been focusing on biodiversity and how to create a more just world for nature and people going forward. And they have networks all across the globe. And so we are going to, you asked about how do we amplify this and how do we share it? We're going to start with them because it's their future.
Yeah, anyway. That sounds terrific. Sounds perfect.
Yeah.
Boy, you are so eloquent. I am very impressed, and I totally agree that we need the emotional driver in order to break through this logjam or this impasse that we're at. Where all of this scientific data in the world is, of course, it's important. We've got to have it, but it's the softer side of it all that I think is really that's the tougher part, to put it that way.
It is a tougher part.
Yeah. Great. Listen, great conversation. I do want to add, I always ask people this question and everybody says, oh, I'm not in balance, but you are an effective individual. You're eloquent. You've done a lot. Your career is impressive. It's, I wouldn't say you're at the end of your career by any stretch. I don't even think you need to even say final act. I'm sure you have lots more acts, but how do you keep balance? How do you maintain, you got to be, you're taking care of that brain and that body. I know.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do I think I maintain balance largely by staying in communication and kind of migrating toward people who are passionate and smart and creative and thinking outside the box a little bit. And that really keeps me going. I mean, all of the boards I've served on and the projects I've done and the crazy things I've tried to do have, really had at the heart, people who are lit up, and there are a lot of people, and that's always refreshing. I also think that, I don't know if I'm an optimist, but I do seem to wake up every day with the sense of how can I help? What can I do? Instead of, this is so far gone, we might as well all just go to the beach and wait for the water to rise. I spend a lot of time outdoors.
Yeah.
I spend a lot of time in nature, and that is my church and my soul food. And so I suppose in a pinch, that's your answer.
It's a great answer. Hey, listen, thanks so much for this conversation. It's been great talking to you.
Likewise, Ted. It's really a pleasure. Thank you.
That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.